Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. I'm Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Our program today is a talk that John Hanna gave at the Burning Man Festival in 2003. In fact, it was the first of the Palenque Norte lectures that we promoted that year. You know, we didn't really have a good idea of what we're in for yet. And right in the middle of his talk, in fact, a dust storm blew in, and everybody in the audience had gas masks and dust masks on, but good old John just kept talking away, so he didn't let it disturb him. He was a real trooper, I'll have to say that for him. In fact, John is such a trooper that the night before the first talk, he came over and actually had to help us put the roof on the pod that we had the talk in. So I don't know many speakers that build their lecture halls and then come give a talk the next day, but John's one of the good guys that can do stuff like that. As most of you already know, John has been a pillar of the tribe for quite a long time. My first introduction to John's work was actually came from Terrence McKenna. It was at a conference I was at in, I guess it was summer of 98, and I remember Terrence saying that if you didn't have a copy of John's book, you really hadn't started your library yet. So, of course, I went out and got a copy right away, and was quite blown away. The book he had out at the time, in fact, he's got it available now in a later edition. It's called The Psychedelic Resource List. And I just, rather than give you the details, I'd suggest you just go out and get it. It's exactly what the title implies. It's a psychedelic resource list, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. You know, the first time I actually met John was at the All Chemical Arts Conference in Hawaii, and I guess it was in the fall of 99. And to make a very long story short, John and I became friends, and he eventually edited my book, The Spirit of the Internet. If you're a member of the MAPS community, by the way, I'm sure you've seen some of John's work on the special art issues he's done for their bulletin. And his most significant contributions to the tribe, in my opinion, are twofold. One is the Mind States Conference, and we just had a very successful Mind State 6 up in San Francisco not long ago, and you can read more about that online at www.mindstates.org, MINDSTATES.org. And the other major project John's involved with is the he's one of the contributors and supporters of the Entheogen Review. And that's Entheogenreview.org, the Entheogen Review. And if you've never had a copy of that in your hands, you don't know what you're missing. So check it out. When I first asked John to give a speech at Burning Man, he jumped right into the fray and says yes. So putting together our program, I just thought it was fitting that he give the first lecture, since John's usually the guy behind the scenes, you know, the wizard pulling the levers behind the conference scene. And personally, I think John really set a good tone for these talks and set the rest of the speakers up in pretty good shape with the audience. But you can decide this for yourself, because here's John Hanna discussing his ideas about drug-inspired metaphysical concepts.
I think that Lorenzo's comment of me putting something together is an overstatement. So this is going to be a very loose talk, and I also want to encourage everyone to participate in this process and share stories related to the topic that they might have experienced. But before I start, I wanted to thank Lorenzo and Mercy and Carla and Don and everyone who's put this incredible camp together and spent so much time folding cardboard, which is cool. So let me think, how do I want to start this? I think I want to start this with just reading a quote from Allen Ginsberg that is kind of describing, I think, a very accurate description of the psychedelic experience, because I feel that this description sort of relates to the idea of drug-inspired metaphysical concepts. And probably everyone here is familiar with R. Gordon Lawson, and he was a banker who first sort of rediscovered, or was involved, one of the first people involved in rediscovering the psilocybe mushrooms. And he has postulated that the origins of religious ideas come from the use of psychoactive drugs, and I don't know whether that's true necessarily, but certainly it's one avenue to religious or spiritual type of thoughts. And so, anyway, I'm going to read this book from Allen Ginsberg, which I think sort of encapsulates that idea. So this was in Playboy magazine. What does a trip feel like? A creeping sensation comes over your body, a change in the planetary nature of your mammal eyeballs and hearing orifices. Then comes realization that you're a spirit inhabiting a vast animal body containing giant apparatuses, holes, circulatory systems, interior canals, and mysterious back alleys of the mind. Any one of these back alleys can be explored for a long, long way, like going back into recollections of childhood, or going forward into the future, imagining all sorts of changes in the body, in the mind, or in the world outside, inventing imaginary universes, or recalling ones that existed, like Egypt. You then realize that all these exist in your mind simultaneously. Slowly, you approach the mysterious feeling that if all these histories and universes exist in your mind at the same time, then what about this one you are, quote, really, unquote, in, or think you are? Does that also exist only in your mind? Then comes the realization that it does exist only in your mind. The mind created it. Then you begin to wonder, who is this mind? At the height of the acid experience, you realize that your mind is the same mind that's always existed in all people at all times, in all places. This is the great mind, the very mind men call God. Then comes a fascinating suspicion. Is this the mind they call God, or what they used to call the devil? Here's where a thumb trip may begin. If you decide it's a demonic creator, you get hung up wondering whether he should exist or not. To get off that train of thought, you might open your eyes and see you're sitting on a sofa in a living room with green plants flowering on the mantelpiece, blah, 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 blah. So I'm not going to continue with this, but I thought that that was a pretty good description of the sort of spiritual aspects. And so part of what I wanted to just put forward, and I don't have any answer for this, is what is the idea of spirituality? Where does this come from? What is it that we think of as spiritual or metaphysical? And I think that it's the sense that we get that this material world is not all that there is, and that there's something beyond that, and that when we're in these enhanced states of mind, we experience that sort of timeless moment that seems very, very real when we experience it. And all manner of ideas might come to us while we're in that state of mind that seem very real and valid. And then we come back to this state of mind, and a lot of them might, you know, in reflection here, seem sort of crazy. And so that fits in with the beyond belief theme of Burning Man this year. And I wanted to talk about a few of the more well-known people who had sort of kind of nutty ideas, let's say, that were drug-inspired. So the first one that I'll just mention briefly, who you're probably all familiar with, is Terence McKenna. And Terence went to the Amazon in 1971. He was 25 years old, and he was on a quest to find TNT-containing plants, and he decided that that was, you know, a very important thing to do because the TNT experience was very strange and otherly. And so he went down there, and instead of finding the TNT-containing plant he was looking for, he hooked up with some mushrooms that were growing all over the place there, and had a number of experiences with the mushrooms that then led him towards these ideas about reality. And he sort of connected this to the I Ching, and the kind of ended up being connected to the Mayan calendar, and he created this time wave theory. And so that's something, you know, that I would consider very much his time wave theory, which you're probably familiar with. It's very much a drug inspired metaphysical belief. There's not, you know, if you were to look at it with a rational mind, it doesn't seem to, you know, hold very much water. But on the other hand, he was fairly convinced that it was true. Towards the end of his life, he became, a little more convinced. Well, now it's easy for me to believe that it's the truth. So, he knew he was checking out, and he felt confident that it didn't matter. But he always had to retain a sense of humor. He always, maybe it's just all a bunch of bullshit. Or actually, he probably would have said horseshit, I think. So that was one person who's pretty well known. Another person who's pretty well known is John Lilly. He was a doctor who did work with dolphins. He was convinced that dolphins were very intelligent and tried to understand how they communicate with each other. He also did work with isolation tanks and ketamine and became fairly involved with ketamine to the point that some people may feel that it wasn't so good that he was doing as much ketamine as he was doing. I remember hearing, I wasn't at this conference, but I remember hearing about a conference where later in his life he was on a panel and it was a question and answer session and people would ask him a question. And every time he was asked a question, he would answer with the same answer, which was 100 milligrams intramuscular ketamine. That's your answer. So he was fairly convinced that it was a good thing. But so he had an experience. I think it was maybe his second LSD experience, where his first LSD experience was fairly good, and his second one he was thrown into a kind of a really negative space. And he had to piece the whole thing together later from memory, but what he had ended up doing was feeling, I guess, sort of unconsciously suicidal. He injected himself with an antibiotic. But he was a doctor. He was familiar with injections. It wasn't, a weird thing for him to do. And he might have thought in his conscious mind that, maybe this will help the bum trip I'm having. But what ended up happening is he cleaned out the needle with some detergent, and there was detergent left in the needle, which was injected into the system, and the bubbles from the detergent went through his lungs and then lodged in his brain and caused him to go into a coma. And he was found sort of on the floor in this state and rushed to the hospital, but they knew who he was and were taking care of him. And he actually ended up going blind for a period of time after that because of the neurological damage, which turned out to be temporary. But during this time when he was sort of in this coma, he had an experience where he met these two beings of light, and they were sort of his guardians, I guess, and they said to him, "We're not really two beings of light, we're actually just one being, and you're part of that, but because of your kind of limited perspective, you're seeing us as these two beings, and we're going to take care of you, and we're looking out for you." And you can, he described the place that he was in as just utter joy, a wonderful space to be in. And they said to him, "Well, you can stay here, or you can go back to your body. And your work in your body isn't finished, but, if you stay here, this is what it's going to be like." How seriously should we take these kinds of ideas? And why do they... one of the things that to me is always interesting is like a religion like Christianity, which, or any organized religion, which over time will build up certain rituals and certain practices, and everybody sort of, just takes them for granted, and it doesn't seem that strange. Like, oh, there's angels, there's beings, they're angels, they live in the heavens, and that's part of it. Or, oh, this person, came back from the dead, it's part of it. And it doesn't seem that strange, but when somebody is telling you, "I am Christ, and I realize this because I took some LSD," then people tend to dismiss that as maybe some brain damage or because of the drugs. So in one way it's really strange because here people are who are taking the LSD, they're having this direct primary religious experience, and they're speaking from personal experience, whereas the people who are just following the Bible maybe they just read something and then they believe it. So which is a weirder way to approach it? So I think I want to move into discussing now I'll talk about one of my own experiences. I took a brief fifth dose of mushrooms one time when I was camping, and it was probably, I think it was about 4 grams of mushrooms, and I was just in my tent, and, you know, with my eyes shut, and I had this experience where I went into what seemed to be like a waiting room of a hospital. The walls were all sort of a drab green color, and there was no one there. It was just me sort of waiting in this waiting room. And these things would float by that were, you know, maybe about this big, sort of like football size, and looked like giant maggots, but, you know, moving sort of through the air. So it was sort of strange with these maggot-like things. And then I saw this creature that was about the size of a small dog that was very furry, but a very insect-like creature with a really nasty, long proboscis that looked like it was sort of, you know, mosquito-type thing. And as soon as it turned around and saw me, an alarm went off. A sound, it made a sound that I sensed it was, you know, sort of alerting everyone in that realm, hey, there's this thing here and it's seeing us. And so it communicated telepathically with me, and it told me, you know, well, the first thing was like, what the hell are you doing here? Why are you seeing us? Like, you're not supposed to be able to see us. And so, just a few mushrooms. So it, you know, it just seemed okay with that answer. It explained to me that what it was this being that lived off of human thought and all of its kind. And the impression I got was little maggot things were the, you know, they were the beings that hadn't hatched yet, and this thing was, you know, an adult. And so they fed on human thought, and human thought was both their nourishment, like food, actual food, and it was also kind of like used as currency somehow. And I got this idea from them that, or from him that, or it, that they weren't necessarily entirely friendly, and that some types of human thought were more valuable than other types of human thought. So if you're just sitting around watching TV, maybe that's not that valuable, but if you're having an orgasm, or if you're stabbing someone and killing them, you know, the very extreme types of human thought or human emotion were more valuable, and that somehow these creatures would manipulate the human experience in such a way so that they would be able to sort of get these better thoughts to live off of. And so it didn't, you know, it was a very parasitic kind of seeming thing, and didn't leave me with a very good feeling. I thought, well, okay, you know, this is a very strange experience, and I was on drugs at the time, and so how seriously do I take this? It seemed very real. It wasn't, you know, it didn't seem, yeah. So maybe they're out there. So it's a creepy thought, really. I mean, because you feel like, you know, in one way, you know, if you think that what if an alien being or alien culture came to our planet from someone else and they saw the way that we treat animals, for example, and that we kill them and eat them and raise them and cage them and do all of these things to animals that, you know, are not particularly nice necessarily to do to another being, or the way that we treat insects, we can spray poisons and just, you know, don't get me started on insects, but I think that insects are the embodiment of the other. They're so different from us. They have an exoskeleton. So they're the exact opposite of us. Their fleshy stuff is on the inside and their skeleton's on the outside. And I think that not only does it represent sort of the other to us, but I also think that they have what is a death charge to them, which is because of that skeleton, because the skeleton to us is representative of death. And so I think that insects, you know, sometimes if you see an ant, your immediate reaction is to squish it with your finger, right? Without even thinking, oh, I'm killing the fish, I'm going to kill it, you know? And then, so they have so much of a death charge that it's kind of like it's a them or me thing. You know, mosquitoes, people have got no problem killing mosquitoes, right? So you know, so it's kind of a crazy thing to think that maybe there's this other dimension where these things are feeding off of us and controlling what it is. So how seriously should I take this? I mean, if I take it really seriously and say that yes, this is true, what can I do? What should I do about it? And the other option is to say, well, yeah, you know, I was just on drugs and it's just something weird that happened. It couldn't possibly be true. It defies rational, you know. with no proof for this. It's possible there's misinterpretation. It's also possible that these, if we're going to accept that there are these things that are interdimensional or other dimensional, that they're just lying to us. I mean, I don't know how seriously to take the things that some of these things are saying. So I wanted to relate that experience because it's an experience that I had where, in the end, what I sort of, you know, how I dealt with it was like, okay, well, weird drug experience, and I'm not going to go around preaching to everyone, look, you know, be careful about what you think, because, you know, really, what you think, you know, you're feeding these things, and maybe they're, you know, growing in numbers, and so, you know, I don't know, but the next thing I wanted to lead to was a person whose name is Zoe Seven, who I actually met at the first Mindscapes conference that I produced, or this, no, it was the first or the second, but anyways, one of the conferences that I produced, and he wrote this book called Into the Void, which when I read the first, and he, you know, he contacted me and said, hey, I'd like to speak at your conference, and when I read the first page, I was just immediately turned off by it, because it was very new agey, and I don't tend to, you know, hold a lot of new age beliefs, and was talking about, well, I'll just give you a little flavor of it. Don't let this turn you off from the book, because it's a great book, but let us first begin by introducing ourselves. We are Zoe Seven, a multidimensional synergy personality cluster. In this reality, we now inhabit the physical body and mind of Joseph Margi. The other five personalities occupying his body mind are Max McCullen, of Heroes.
Anyway, so he lists the names of the different people that are living in his body. He says, as you probably have noticed by now, as a group we are six in number, yet we call ourselves Zoe Seven. Let us explain the reason for this peculiarity. The psychological and psychic merger we have recently undergone is a new experiment in consciousness for all of us. This consolidation follows the principle of synergy, which combines individual units, parts of a whole, in such a way so as to produce a result that is greater than the sum of the units. Blah, 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 blah. So, you know, it just seemed like there's a bunch of New Age crap. But on the other hand, you know, I thought, well, it was a free book, so I'll keep reading. And so as I kept reading it, I realized that there were a lot of very interesting things to me. One was that Zoe came to psychedelics sort of later in his life than I did. I think he was about 31 when he first started experimenting with them. And he's, I think he just turned 36. So it was not that long ago that he started messing around with psychedelics. He was doing so in a vacuum. He didn't have any friends that were taking psychedelics. He didn't know anything about it, and was sort of a little bit pre-internet, although he was getting some information from the internet. So he just started taking a whole lot of stuff just randomly, sort of to see what it would do to him. Things like motion sickness pills in high doses. Whatever he could get his hands on, because he wasn't very well connected. And, you know, he wrote down the experiences that he had, and he's not particularly someone who has had a great deal of formal education. So his book, another thing that first sort of turned me off from the book was it's just riddled with sort of typos and grammatical errors and things that, I thought, this guy's not too bright. But what really impressed me was that he just kept going into the trenches and taking things and writing down his experiences. And when I started going through it, I would notice over and over again experiences that either were very similar to ones that I had that he described very well, or things that I'd heard other people say that they had experienced. So he had a really good overview of the psychedelic experience. One of the things that he was doing was he was taking psychedelics along with various mind machines, which can be anything from something that fits onto your, over your eyes, that has a sort of a light and sound kind of situation going on, and has earplugs where it changes your brainwave state, and he would do that in conjunction with taking psychedelics. And he started realizing that he was having experiences in other sort of dimensions as other people that were just as real as these experiences that we're having here. And he could go back and replicate them. But he could go back to the same person's body in some other, he calls them parallel universes or probable universes, and kind of delves into layman's understanding of quantum mechanics to explain his theory as to how all of this works. And a very interesting theory, so, but very out there. I have some extra copies of these books. So if you aren't familiar with it and it sounds interesting to you, just take one. I don't have enough for everyone, but I have a few. So we became friends, and he's someone who I kind of would categorize. If we're kind of, you know, we're very interested in the same things, but we're kind of on opposite spectrums as far as our beliefs about the things that we're interested in. And I would put him more into the camp of a true believer. And by that, I mean someone who, if he had gone through the experience that I did with the insect thing that was sucking our thoughts, he would very much be like, look, there are these insect things that are sucking our thoughts, and you guys need to wake up. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you're laughing, but they're sucking your thoughts right now, and your laughing response to me is, you know, is something that, so, I mean, but the reason that I think it's important is that his experience of that and his embracing the ideas that have come to him in these psychedelic states is from his own experience. He's actually experienced it. It's like I said, it's not, he didn't read it in a book. He went into the trenches and was told various things by these creatures or entities or things. And, you know, they said, well, this is the way to do it. Well, this very much parallels the ideas embraced in shamanism, in traditional shamanism, that you go in and you can work in these spaces with those things that you come in contact with. And it's a very different sort of a belief than the, you know, the Western kind of rationalist or scientist view that we have here. So I went down to the Amazon where Zoe was involved in producing ayahuasca sessions, and I was speaking at one of those. And if that's something you're interested in, I highly recommend that you go to one of these things. I have some flyers for that too up here. I'll send them sort of in between you so they don't fly away. But the next one that they're doing has the artists Robert Venosa and Martina Hoffman, which maybe some of you are familiar with their artwork. So you go to the Amazon, you take ayahuasca sort of every other night, and then in the mornings the next day you discuss your experiences, where they have like art painting sessions where you can paint visions that you have. So when I was there with him, we were taking ayahuasca, and one of the people who was there was a Peruvian shaman named Pablo Amaringo, that you might be familiar with some of his art. This is an example of his art on Lorenzo's shirt. So he is just the sweetest guy and a wonderful man, and he gave up shamanism because just sort of a brief reason, the description of why he gave up shamanism is that he was a shaman who would heal people. And there are different kinds of shaman, and that in South America, there's a lot of belief that illness is magically produced. And so you go to the shaman to get healed. So he would wake up in the morning, there'd be people who lined up at his door because he was very successful at what he did. And he would heal these people, and the next day there'd be more people, and heal them. After a while, he started getting very sick, and so he went to another shaman, and he found out that what was going on was that the shaman that were making people sick were pissed off at him because he was sort of negating what they were doing. He was healing these people that should be sick, according to them, because they were making these people sick. And so, you know, his attitude was like, well, look, if you guys were just better shaman, you know, I wouldn't be able to cure them. It's not my fault. I'm a guy who cures people, and you are people who make people sick, and we each do our thing, and it's not my fault that you're not, you know, doing a very good job. But, so a number of shamans sort of ganged up and ended up making Pablo very sick. And so he went to this one shaman and said, well, you know, what am I going to do about this? And what the shaman said to him is, you need to kill those other shamans. You have to, the only way for you to get out of the situation and to continue being a shaman is if you kill them. Because if they're still alive, they will keep fighting you, they will keep making you sick, and it's not going to get any better, and it will get worse. And so Pablo, you know, was like, well, I'm a healer, I'm not someone who kills people, and so he decided that his best course of action was to give up shamanism, and so he stopped being an ayahuasca shaman, and he doesn't do that anymore. But he's an artist, and he paints these beautiful paintings of the visions that he had while he was on ayahuasca,
And it's neat because when you look at his paintings, you can see some things in there that you think, it's really weird that in the sort of Peruvian shaman we have UFOs in their paintings. You know, and how does this tie into our ideas of UFOs? That this is something that, or angels or mermaids or other things that you wouldn't think necessarily. But it's because he's had experience interacting with those beings. So anyway, Pablo was there at this seminar, and Zoe was there, and this woman, Sylvia Colavoy, was there, who's the person who produced the seminars. And there's about 20 people at a session. And so one of these people, we're all really stoned on ayahuasca. And one of these people was apparently a psychic of some type. Now, when someone says that they're a psychic, I don't know. I tend to be skeptical and think, what number am I thinking? And I have never gotten, a sufficient answer to that, so I tend to be a little skeptical about psychics to some degree, although I've also had experiences had an experience with my friend Carlo, which was very strange that occurred, that, almost seems like you're a psychic. So, I'm not... That whole thing with the bracelets and the salt and, when you were like, oh, you should put those bracelets in salt.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway. So what happened, at any point, if I just seem like I'm rambling, tell me to shut up and we'll get a question. So what happened was, this woman who was a psychic apparently, under the influence of ayahuasca, became convinced that Pablo was there to... steal our energy. Like, he was not there for good reasons. That he was there, to use shamanic tricks and steal our energy. So the person who produced the conference or the seminar came up to me and said, John, what do you think about this? This woman's like, she says Pablo's not here for good reasons, and this is, and she clearly was taking it very seriously because she's a psychic. I think I would take it with a little bit of a grain of salt and just see how it develops. Maybe she's interpreting things not correctly, I don't think that Pablo is here to steal our energy. But what it made me realize that interaction was how through the use of psychedelics, people can become very primed to a mind state that allows them to believe magical thinking, that the world is a magical place. And that this is probably part of the reason why those cultures that use psychedelics regularly have this sort of belief system that illness is created magically and can be cured magically. And so it was an interesting thing to be witness to this kind of a shifting in belief systems where you come into it from a more of a rational perspective, and then after doing it for a while, you kind of shift into this perspective of, maybe there are a whole lot of things out there that are beyond belief that we can't explain, that are just happening, and it seems, coincidences. One of the things that Zoe is very big on is coincidences. There's something also that comes up with ketamine users a lot. If they're using a lot of ketamine, is that all of a sudden everything becomes very coincidental and significant. And so, anyway, the next day with Pablo, the woman said something like, "Oh no, Pablo's not here to hurt us." I was on drugs, or I misinterpreted things, and he's here to help us, and everything's good. And so, but it, at the time, it was a crisis. We were, what are we going to do? It's like those insect things stuck in our thoughts. Pablo's there, and it's not good, and how are we going to get rid of him? So I want to talk about another, I mentioned ketamine, and I want to talk about two experiences with ketamine. One was that I had here on the playa, in 96, and it was the first time I had done ketamine intramuscularly. Thankfully, for me, it's making me a little less nervous about it. The person who was shooting me up was actually an anesthesiologist who happened to bring a whole lot of ketamine and some equipment, pulse oximeter, that my eyes are good, it's just my throat this morning. Thanks, man. So anyway, I got shot up with this ketamine, and I'm having my ketamine experience. I really hadn't had a ketamine experience before that, although I did once. I didn't get off on it at all. So part of the experience was kind of a typical or out-of-body experience, I guess you'd call it, and I was floating above the camp. And I was looking down at all of Burning Man from sort of an aerial perspective, and I was seeing the whole camp, how it was laid out, and just floating along like Superman, but not real fast, you know, but above everything, and checking out the camp. I was afterwards, oh, that was really weird to get this aerial view of the camp, but I didn't think that I really actually had been floating above the camp. I just thought that in my mind I created this, you know, here I am at Burning Man, and this is the kind of what primes me going into the experience, and so it makes logical sense that I might have some visions of Burning Man. And so I didn't give much thought to it other than I thought it was a neat experience. So next day or 2 days later, we were going to this Watchman boom, and I had taken some PCB for that, and I was walking along and I had this real strong feeling of deja vu, and it was very strange because, you know, it was a really strong feeling. Everything around me sort of looked familiar, but it didn't look exactly familiar, it just sort of looked familiar. So I kept walking, and I had the experience again. I was like, all this looks really familiar. And I knew that I had not seen what I was looking at previously, because we purposely were taking a route to the man that we had not walked, because we wanted to see more of the city. And so after the third time that it hit me that I felt like I'd really seen where I was, you know, seeing landmarks, that, but I've seen this before, but I haven't seen it before, what I realized was that I had seen it before, but from above. I was looking at it from a different perspective, so the landmarks were all the same, but it was my viewpoint on them that wasn't the same. So it sort of, you know, in my mind it seemed like, well, okay, this is really weird, because it kind of does seem like the ketamine experience I had was an out-of-body experience, and I was actually looking at things, and I don't have any way of reconciling that in a rational perspective other than to say that maybe I was having an out-of-body experience, and that actually is the way things work. So I want to briefly mention another ketamine story, because I think that ketamine is an interesting drug, and I'll mention two stories that relate to kind of metaphysical things. And the first one is a gentleman who I met on the playa a couple nights ago, who I guess was maybe a ketamine dealer, so he had lots of ketamine. And when there's lots of ketamine around, what I've noticed is people tend to get into patterns of a lot of use of ketamine. And so this guy apparently was using ketamine a lot, maybe every day, maybe multiple times a day, and said that he realized, when he realized that he had a problem, was he had these alien entities that were talking to him and that were telling him that they were sort of controlling the world. And so this seems in some way, it's a weird kind of a repeating theme, you know, this idea that there's these alien, some kind of alien things that are controlling the world, because it's kind of what John Lilly was talking about. And it's sort of that insect thing that I ran into. And so his experience was there were these alien things controlling the world. And how they communicated was that they had altered his DNA on the... And that they were sending messages through his hair to each other over by wind transference. So his DNA had changed, and somehow they were communicating through his hair. Whenever the wind blew, they would send messages back and forth. And he had been shaving all his body hair off because he, you know, they weren't friendly entities. They were. So he had been shaving his hair everywhere because he didn't want the messages to be sent. And so that was when he kind of realized, well, maybe I've gone too far. Maybe I'm taking too much ketamine. And he backed off a little bit. But other people might, you know, go further with that and say, okay, well, you know, the true believer might take it further in the way that John Lilly took it further and really, you know, actively sort of understood the world through this coincidence control sensor. Another sort of interesting ketamine-related metaphysical thing, a friend told me recently about experience where he and several others were all on ketamine, and they'd all entered a shared mind state. So the idea is, should we make value judgments about these substances with regard to their use insofar as presenting something, I mean, I'm paraphrasing what she said, but insofar as presenting something that is truthful or useful to us, rather than just allowing us to sort of become deluded. I was just going to comment that my friend had made a comment about different drugs and the reliability of the information that you get through them, and you say something like, well, that with mescaline, you get kind of 80% of what you get from that. It's good information. It's true and good. And with mushrooms, maybe about 50% of it, or 60% of it, is true and good. And with ketamine, 0% is true and good. But I don't buy the zero, because I think that my own experience with that sort of out-of-body situation seemed very provable. I mean, it seemed like... So, yeah, but I think that, you know, people do need to realize that ketamine is not... I've known a lot of people who've had problems with ketamine, so... You know, you can get, yeah.
I have a friend who used ketamine in a way that I could never, to me ketamine is just very strange and a bizarre experience, but I don't find it to be a particularly useful experience. Sometimes it's enjoyable and it's always interesting, but it's not something that I've ever felt like when I came back from it, that there were things that I could apply in my life necessarily and make changes that are beneficial. But I have a friend who has told me that when he goes into ketamine, it's like looking at sort of a computer screen, and that he can go through files and see, like, okay, well, here's one, it's a file where it causes me to have the urge to smoke cigarettes, and just hit the delete key, and he actually says that this is something that he uses ketamine for, sort of metaprogramming to change his behavior in this reality, that it works for him, that he's able to do that. That's not something that's been my experience, so I can't speak to it except to say that I believe what he's saying, and certainly it seems reasonable for, you know, I don't think he's lying to me. So for some people, I think it can be a useful tool like that. And the problem is, you need to, in order to find out if it's a useful tool like that, then you need to take it enough that you know. And maybe if you've taken it that much, then you become sort of deluded. I don't know, So the idea is that maybe it's better to take naturally occurring chemicals rather than artificial chemicals because they have a longer history of use, and so perhaps maybe they're safer. I think the thing about chemicals, when people say, well, I prefer natural chemicals to synthetic chemicals, or not synthetic, but artificial chemicals, one of the things that happens is that we later then find out that, oh, it turns out, like, methamphetamine is a good example, is a synthetic or artificial rather chemical, but now it's been found in a plant. So, and DMT was another one that was, you know, found in plants later after it had been synthesized. So it may be that someday we find LSD in a plant. The idea of building a relationship with synthetics goes into ideas by a gentleman named Rupert Sheldrake. That's where I'm going to segue it to. And he has these ideas of fields of energy, morphogenetic fields, what he calls morphogenetic fields, where, for example, if something is brand new, it doesn't have very much or any of a morphogenic field. And he'll use the example of rats running through a maze, where the first time they run through a maze, it takes them a certain while to do it. But then later, rats all over the world will be able to do that same maze quicker. And so this is something, he's a biologist and he's actually sort of studied this and come up with this theory. I don't know that I buy into it or don't buy into it. I don't have a strong feeling one way or another to it. But he's actually someone who's trying to take the scientific method and look at sort of paranormal things. And one of the things that he's just written a book recently called The Sense of Being Stared At. And he actually has done studies. It's a real easy study to replicate, so he's got a lot of data points on it. And the idea is that if someone's staring at us from behind, sometimes we might get a feeling that there's somebody staring at us and turn around and we'll see that there's somebody staring at us. And so he's actually looked at this kind of in a scientific way. And when you look at all of the data points that he's gathered, it's somewhere between 55 and 60% of the time people can tell when they're being stared at. But they can't tell when they're not being stared at. When they're not being stared at, it falls back to random, 50% of the time, which is what you would expect, just randomly, that 50% of the time, if you're guessing, you get it right and you get it wrong. So he's saying, well, what's going on? Well, he thinks that there's some connection between what the person who is doing the seeing and what they're looking at. The objects are not necessarily in our mind that our mind is projecting outwards. And that this is one of these things tied into this idea of morphogenetic fields. I wanted to bring up ketamine just one more time with relation to
this story that I was talking about earlier, where my friend took this ketamine with a group of people, and they all entered this singular mind state where they were all sharing one mind. And somebody else walked into the room and didn't know that they were on ketamine and smoked some acacia obtusifolia resin, which contains primarily a high amount of DMT, and was launched into a ketamine mind state and was there with them in the shared mind state from smoking DMT, and was very confused because he had never done ketamine and was, what the hell's going on? You know, I've never experienced this. This isn't what it was supposed to be like, and why is this, why am I? So he thought that in his mind state, he thought that he had kind of broken the world, or that he was the one that was responsible for this thing happening because I'm smoking the DMT. So what's going on there? What's happening when people share a mind state from taking substances, sort of telepathic kind of experiences? R. Gordon Lawson, when he first took mushrooms in Mexico with his wife, he apparently had a situation where he realized, I think, that his daughter had a baby. You know, he knew that she had given birth on a particular day at a particular time. It's like, oh yeah. And then later verified that was true. So there's some interesting things that can occur on psychedelics that I think fall into like a kind of a paranormal or ESP or telepathy area. And it's very unfortunate that the substances are illegal, because it kind of precludes any serious scientific study. All that sort of stuff has to be done underground. And so, you know, I encourage people to do that, to try to take things and see if they can test out whether or not these things enhance telepathic communications. Your conversation reminded me of something that I wanted to mention. I sort of lost the train of thought. I brought up Zoe Seven and his work, and the reason that I brought him up is because more recently he has had experiences where what he is doing is combining salvia divinorum and ayahuasca. And so he feels, and I don't know if it's true, but he feels like he might have been the first person who has, while on a stiff dose of ayahuasca, smoked a very potent extract of salvinorin A enhanced extract of salvia divinorum. And what occurred in doing that was he had this huge download of information from these entities that were saying, okay, well, it's very important that people take ayahuasca and salvia together. What we are is a hybrid entity that is being created through the combination of these two plants. And what has happened in the past is this, okay, there's ayahuasca and there's salvia divinorum, but both of these things have kind of been profaned through improper use. And so the download of information told them, okay, well, you got to take ayahuasca 8 times, you got to take salvia divinorum 8 times, then you have to start taking them together. And in doing so, you're helping to create this hybrid, which is an energy that is a love-based energy, which is going to kind of help us. Zoe feels that kind of we're all in danger, that humanity is in danger, and that there are these kind of alien reptilian creatures that are kind of sucking our energy or working on the outskirts of reality, what we perceive as reality, and that it's only this hybrid that's sort of going to save us. So he's moved into areas where, you know, this is all coming from his own personal experience with the plants, that the plants have told him these things. So he's taking their advice, and he's, okay, I'm going to try to... So one other idea that I wanted to bring up is, there's in Australia, there's these acacia trees that grow that contain DMT, and there's been some people who have been cutting down and harvesting the DMT from them, and there's a resin that's going around which people are just calling acacia resin. It's from the plant Acacia obtusifolia, which is a plant that you can grow here. There's no reason that people should be growing it, and it takes about 5 years to reach sort of a tree height, and then you can harvest it. So it's something that's very reasonable and doable to grow here. But in Australia they grow and all over the place, and so this guy went and decided he's going to cut one down and harvest the DMT from it, and he did so in what some people are saying is very cavalier manner. He's just looking at making a buck, selling this stuff, went in without good intentions towards the trees, chopped it down, cut it, extracted it, and then he went back to do it again, and so he did it with another tree, and the tree didn't contain any DMT. There was nothing. He got nothing out of it. And so the speculation that these people have is, well, the trees knew that he was sort of like, didn't have good intentions with what he was doing. And so when he came to cut down the next tree, they stopped their DMT production. They just stopped it right there. But that if somebody else came who had good intentions and was to cut down a tree, that that person would be able to harvest the DMT. Now, I don't know, you know, they wanted to test this. Their idea was, well, we're going to create some type of a rigorous scientific test and make sure that, you know, or see if this is actually occurring, because they believed that it was occurring. My question is, how do you test the intentions of a plant? How do you, I mean, sure, you can test whether or not the plant contained DMT or whether it didn't contain DMT, and at what time, and whether the human had intentions, but how can you prove that it was the plant that had these intentions?
Ask the plant questions and
ask the plant. So it's an idea that sort of, you know, is in some ways it's beyond belief. It's not, but this is what, they believe it to the degree that they want to actually, you know, do some testing to see if it's true.
I have to say, just on the mechanics of smoked DMT, I was someone who had a very difficult time smoking DMT because I felt it, but for me, the smoke was so harsh in my lungs that I would get a nice big hit and I'd immediately cough it out. And so I sort of feel like a jackass wasting the DMT. After the first hit, I did not want to smoke another one because my lungs hurt so bad. And so what I recently have come across is an idea for the production of a pipe. And the pipe is called the machine. It's just the slang term for it. And the way that it's made is you take like a little tiny Hennessy cognac bottle, which you can buy at any hard liquor store, the type of thing that you would get on an airplane. And the reason that you use a Hennessy bottle is because the way that the bottle is constructed, it has like a divot in the bottom of it with this sort of preformed weak spot, and you can hit that with a nail or a pair of scissors or something and break it out. You could drink the Hennessy first, so you're not, unless you're drinking glass shards. So then you've got this empty Hennessy bottle, and you go to the store, and they sell in the grocery store, or sometimes like places like Rite Aid, will sell these steel wool scrubber pads that are, it's not steel wool, and don't use steel wool, because steel wool can ignite. But if you get a really coarse type of steel wool, that'll work. But the fine steel wool ignites. You know, it's flammable, so you don't want to use that. But get the really coarse scrubber pad steel wool. Soak it in alcohol or something if you're concerned about it containing any kind of oil, treatment with oils, or you know, or burn it a little bit first to try to burn that stuff up. But then you just put a little plug of the steel wool in the neck of the bottle, and then so let's say that this is it. So you plug up the neck with the steel wool, and then how you hit off it is you draw from the hole like that, and you heat the DMT until you put the DMT just on powder on top of the steel wool, and you heat it until it melts but doesn't vaporize into the steel wool. Now what this does is it, when you then heat it from below and you take the hit, what it does is, because of the properties of the steel wool, the DMT sort of chases all up the steel wool. Doesn't have anywhere to run to, it runs all over the place, and it vaporizes very quickly. So you get a really big hit of DMT from this pipe, big enough to get off good on one hit, and I don't know why, but for some reason using this pipe, the DMT is not as harsh as it is if you smoke it like in a regular crack pipe or something.
Maybe,
because when you're actually burning, the DMT produces iron oxides and things. So it's more. So anyway, now I have a good way to smoke DMT, so I'm excited about doing more of that. But for me, DMT is just—it's not particularly. I don't know if it's particularly insightful for me. It's just—it's entirely weird. It's just different. It's very different, and I can't explain. It doesn't seem like it's coming from my imagination. Like some things that I take, I think, oh well, I could have just seen that or thought it or whatever, but DMT is so other that, So the question is if you consume a monoamine oxidized inhibitor prior to smoking DMT, does it make the DMT experience longer? And anecdotal evidence is yes, absolutely. And you can even smoke small quantities of harmaline or even just straight Syrian roux prior to smoking DMT. It will extend it. It slows it down. It changes the character of it. So what you were saying about it moving so fast, that's one way to kind of slow things down a little bit.
Yeah, there's concerns about monoamine oxidized inhibitors and consuming those with certain pharmaceuticals that might be give you either very high blood pressure or very low blood pressure. And so everybody, before you take any sort of monoamine oxidized inhibitor, should be aware of what you shouldn't take with that. But DMT is something that is okay to take.
I have a, after that machine for smoking DMT was sort of first brought into a friend of mine's awareness, he smoked a dose of acacia resin with it and entered a place. He said he'd never been, and he's got a lot of experience with DMT, and he said he'd never been this far in, and in this place, what he became aware of was that we're sort of all one being that has been divided and split up into all these little beings, but that what we are now working for is, we're working towards becoming one being again, or the ability to have the knowledge that we're one being at all times rather than just through these sort of brief glimpses. And he, came back really, really convinced, he's sort of on a mission now. Look, we're all one being. Because of the intense experience that he had, after he smoked this big hit, he went into this place and was having a great time. Well, in this world, his body started convulsing, landed on the ground, started doing the flippy floppy fish kind of epileptic seizure thing. His friends became very concerned and were holding him down so that he wouldn't hurt himself. And, so when he came back to, all his friends were there and was just very loving, like, oh, my friends are giving me a big hug. He is how he interpreted it. Later he thought, like, gosh, if I had interpreted it like they're all physically manhandling me to make sure that I don't, but he turned purple and everybody was very concerned. So that's one thing you really can get using this machine. You really can get just a huge dose. Apparently, it's not harmful. I mean, everybody's probably seen the films of the traditional peoples who blow this stuff up their nose and then fall on the ground and thrash it out and then get up and do it again. So, but if you're going to be doing it, it's probably good to have some friends around to make sure that you don't have any problems.
If you have not taken nitrous while you were on a strong psychedelic, you are missing out. And I mean that really seriously. If you have, I've met people I couldn't believe. I'm like, you've never taken nitrous on top of 2CB or something. I mean, there's no point in doing nitrous without being on a strong psychedelic, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Basically, it's like slamming everything into hyperdrive. You get, you just get so much more. It goes to 11.
If you were on a desert island and you could only take one thing with you,
but if you can't have this, I'm not like a daily smoker, I don't smoke a lot, but it's so useful. It's so useful for introspection and for psychological evaluation and for meditation, and like you said, going into it with intention. And people kind of use, a lot of people, and I'm not placing any judgment on this, but a lot of people use cannabis in the same way that a lot of people use alcohol, which is just, I feel good and it's fun and whatever, but I think that cannabis is a hugely important tool that is downplayed by many people.
Right on.
Also, I don't buy into the Montitex would take a mushroom during the night time. There's this idea if you take them during the day that it'll cause you to go insane. And a lot of people who hold ayahuasca rituals hold them at night. And I don't buy into that myself. I think it's very good to take these things during the day. And in fact, I think that you are more likely to have sort of very dark, disturbing, like bodily fluids and maggots and going through the earth and just all this very disturbing imagery, which is, it's good to go through that once in a while, but I don't do that every time. And I think you're more likely to have that at night than you are in the daytime. I think you're more likely to have sort of very loving, positive, energetic experience that is not sort of mired down in kind of, banks of blood and all that gross, wormy stuff. I just, when you were describing that, it actually just reminded me that I have had the great experience during the day, and I used to get this when I was a kid on acid, and it always was just right before I lost it. It would all come together and snap into place onto this grid, and then at that point, I would, you know, I mean, I was, it was, I don't think they say a bad trip, but it was the thing, like, it was very meaningful that this cord was moved there. It's, you know, everything aligned, everything was synchronous, and, you know, yeah, so yeah, it was not a good thing necessarily. When it locked into place, then it was the sort of the delusional. It's really easy to get into bad spaces when you're on drugs. It's much easier to get into bad spaces, and yeah, exactly what you said, as far as like going down the wrong, oh, this, and it's a trap in a way, because one wrong thought leads to another, wrong thought leads to another. So we have to be very careful about that too. On the other hand, some people just don't want to be here, and if that's their decision too, then that needs to be respected. But it's hard. It's a little harder to respect it when it was, I mean, I don't know if it is or not, but for me it is a little harder to respect it when it seems like it was a drug-induced action that it seems like, well, maybe if they had been considering that from a non-drug-induced point of view, they wouldn't have taken that action. But on the other hand, I think that if you have a really important decision to make in life, like something very, very important is weighing on you, one thing that I found that works really well is to take MDMA. And consider it from a straight perspective, and then take MDMA and consider it from that perspective, and to try to equally value both perspectives. Don't just go off on whatever MDMA told you, but to try to view it from those two perspectives. That's a hugely helpful tool for me. That I don't use that much, but if I have something very serious that I need to. Okay, on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up. But I do, and maybe Lorenzo will say some more about this, but there's going to be talks here. Every day at noon and at 2. And so, is it 2 now? Have I just been?
No, we're not.
Okay. So come back, and somebody else cool is going to be talking, and there's a schedule posted. And thanks for coming to listen to me, too. And again, there's my flyers here, and then also I'm going to give this just a short commercial plug for this book that Lorenzo mentioned, which is now in its 4th edition. And it's the Psychedelic Resource List. It's a book that I've written, and it just pretty much is exactly what it says. If there's something related to psychedelics you're interested in, this will give you a clue as to where to find it, including things like research chemicals, all good stuff. All good stuff.
We're going to thank John for our initial blanket lecture, and thank all of you for being here. It's going to be very memorable. It's a little dusty, but then we make it memorable.
So there you have it, the historic first Palenque Norte lecture at Burning Man. And I do hope you paid some attention to John's comments about Zoe 7. And the years that have passed since John gave this talk, Zoe, who I consider to be a good friend, by the way, has really moved the bar up quite a bit higher when it comes to consciousness exploration. And right now he's spending most of his time in the Amazon, and it's obviously agreed with him. And we're lucky enough to corner him the next time he comes California way. I hope to have him on as a guest here in the Psychedelic Salon. So, thank you to John for giving Zoe a plug there. And speaking of plugs, I'd like to also give one to my friends Jacques Wells and Cordell at Chateau Hayuk. They've been kind enough to let us use some of their fine music for our theme song here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, I guess that's about it for today. I do hope you'll join us for the next edition of the Psychedelic Salon, when we'll be presenting Alex Gray and his wife Allison and daughter Zena in a talk they gave at the Palenque Norte lectures at the 2003 Burning Man, and it was titled Art, Love, Family, and Psychedelics. I'm sure you're not going to want to miss this one. Well, for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.